Good evening, one and all, and a very hearty welcome to you on behalf of the Historical Society of the Courts of the State of New York. And we thank you for yet another full house, although to be frank, I promised Judge Friedman we would wait until she came back with her cookies. But we're going to barrel ahead anyway. I think each and every one of you, and it's no surprise for me when I look down at my Court of Appeals family, I'm looking at Judge Abdus-Salam, Judge Rivera, Judge Smith. I know Judge Siparik is here as well. Of course, you notice Judge Reed is up here alongside me. So it's not a surprise that they have made a spectacular choice. But might I say that each and every one of you has made an utterly spectacular choice to be with us this evening for what I know is going to be an absolutely spectacular program entitled An American Tragedy, the Law and the Arts. Now, my fabulous colleague, my former colleague, the Court of Appeals Judge Susan Reed and I have spent a long time conferencing with each other about how we were going to plan this introduction. And we unanimously reached a conclusion, which we often did, very often did. We unanimously concluded that when it comes to opening remarks at a program such as this, most definitely, briefer is better. Briefer is better. And so we're going to stick to that, and we're each here to enforce that we stay with that principle. We don't want to lose a single instant of the substance of the law segment, which is orchestrated by Professor Susan Herman, or the arts segment, which is under the baton of Francesca Zambello. So Judge Reed and I agreed that in addition to a very, very hearty welcome, that I would briefly set the stage and convey special thanks, and then she would give a proper introduction of each of tonight's two very special guests. The program, of course, centers on an actual New York State court case, People Against Chester Gillette, a drama that began on July 11, 1906, when 22-year-old Chester Gillette took 20-year-old Grace Brown, then in a condition, according to the words of the Court of Appeals, that could be legitimated only by marriage. When he took her out, yes, they did say things so beautifully back then. When he took her out on a rented rowboat on Big Moose Lake in Herkimer County, from which she never returned. Now, the incident at the time received huge press attention, culminating barely 2 years later in the conviction and execution of Chester Gillette. But the underlying story gained forever fame as the subject of the great Theodore Dreiser classic, An American Tragedy, followed by two and possibly even three very popular films over the next decades. Who could ever forget A Place in the Sun, starring Montgomery Clift and Shelley Winters and Elizabeth Taylor? I've seen it so many times. And I don't know how many of you have seen that Woody Allen film, Match Point. I think that belongs there too. But there were all those films over the next decades. And then ultimately, and most phenomenally of all, a truly fantastic opera that opened at the Opera House, the Metropolitan Opera House, just a couple of years ago. So what a treat we have ahead of us tonight, don't we? That the story has lived on with such consuming interest for well over a century speaks to the timelessness of its messages, and you'll hear a lot more about the messages in words and in music from our great speakers, and we even have some vocalists tonight as well. So before ceding the microphone to Judge Reed to introduce our great speakers tonight, I'm going to close with profound thanks to the Historical Society of the Courts of the State of New York, to its great executive director, Marilyn Marcus. I am facing her. A round of applause for you, Marilyn. And to every single one of the dedicated officers and supporters of the Historical Society. And so long as I have you on the edge of your seats with a well-deserved excitement and anticipation about tonight's program, I want to add a reminder to each of you that the Historical Society, sponsor of so many tremendous programs like tonight's, is in fact a membership organization. And guess what? Each of you can join, and you should join. And you'll find the materials right outside the room that will enable you to become a member. And by joining as a member, best of all, you too can work with us in putting together great events like this that draw on the magnificent history of the courts of the state of New York. And with that, I think I'm still within my time, Susan. I now turn the microphone over to my partner here at the podium, Judge Reed.
Well, as you have heard, I have the happy task of introducing our two speakers. In order of appearance, they are Francesca Zambello and Susan Herman. Francesca is currently the artistic and general director of the Glimmerglass Festival in Cooperstown, New York, and the artistic director of the Washington National Opera in Washington, D.C. As many in this audience may know, one of Washington's biggest opera fans is Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I'm facing her right now. Her portrait's on the back wall. An opera fan and another notable New Yorker, who will speak at Glimmerglass again this summer. In fact, Francesca has scheduled, in addition to productions of An American Tragedy, Madame Butterfly, Ariadne in Naxos, and Carousel, a full menu of programs related to the operas. These programs range from Justice Ginsburg's presentation to literary evenings at Hyde Hall, events at the Fenimore Art Museum, and recitals on the grounds and at the Baseball Hall of Fame. The Alice Busch Theater at Glimmerglass is a wonderful, intimate opera house in a beautiful lakeside setting, and Cooperstown is one of our state's most charming small towns. Now, I am an upstater, so I may be a little biased, but I truly believe that. I would urge any of you who have not yet experienced the Glimmerglass Festival to consider making the pilgrimage to Cooperstown this summer so you can at last discover what you have been missing all these years. When not in upstate New York, Francesca is a globetrotter who communicates with her most loyal audience members through her traveling iPad. And that iPad really travels. Francesca's work often takes her outside the United States to the Teatro alla Scala, the Bolshoi, Covent Garden, the Munich Staatsoper, Paris Opera, and the English National Opera, not to mention recent trips to venues in Oman and China, where she directed the world premiere of Artist Excalibur at the National Center for the Performing Arts in Beijing. Francesca has also staged plays and musicals on Broadway, at the Royal National Theater, BAM, the Guthrie Theater, and even Disneyland. Our second speaker, equally distinguished, is Susan Herman, the Centennial Professor of Law at Brooklyn Law School, where she teaches courses in criminal law and procedure and constitutional law, and seminars on law and literature. Terrorism and civil liberties are other specialties of hers. She writes extensively on constitutional and criminal procedure topics for both legal and non-legal publications, and her most recent book, Taking Liberties, The War on Terror and the Erosion of American Democracy, published by Oxford University Press in October 2011, is the winner of the 2012 IIT Chicago Kent College of Law Roy C. Palmer Civil Liberties Prize. Other publications include two additional books, Terrorism, Government and Law, National Authority and Local Autonomy in the War on Terror, where she's editor and co-author with Paul Finkelman, and The Right to a Speedy Trial, which is part of a series on the Constitution. Susan has discussed issues of constitutional law on radio, including a variety of NPR shows, on television, including programs on PBS, C-SPAN, NBC, MSNBC, and a series of appearances on Today in New York. and in print media, including Newsday and the New York Times. In addition, she has been a frequent speaker at academic conferences and continuing legal education events, lecturing and conducting workshops for various groups of judges and lawyers, and in non-legal events, including speeches at the U.S. Army War College and many other venues. She has also participated in Supreme Court litigation, writing and collaborating on amicus curiae briefs on a range of constitutional criminal procedure issues for the ACLU, which she has served successively as general counsel, a member of the ACLU Board of Directors, and since 2008, president. Susan received a BA from Barnard College and a JD from New York University School of Law. Her many, many writings, and believe me, there are many, many writings, her CV contains pages and pages, including a favorite of mine, a discussion of the jurisprudence of another distinguished Barnard and NYU Law School alumna, Judith S. Kay, whom I think you just saw giving her version of a high five to Susan. Having fulfilled my pledge to Judge Kay to keep the introductions brief, I now cede the program to Francesca and the vocalists.
This is a very different kind of theater than I'm used to. It's a pleasure to be here with you all, a great honor. And I certainly am very grateful to Susan and Judith. They're two judges who are active attendees at many things that I've directed at opera houses, not only upstate, but at the Met and in Washington at the Kennedy Center. And I'm very happy to see, I call her Ruth, but I know how important you are, Ruth, so listen, thank you for all your help. In a way, she's probably the most famous person in America who actually cares about opera, so we're very grateful to her. She's a regular attendee and performer at Glimmerglass because since I came there 4 years ago, I have had her do a lecture every year on opera and law. A lot of operas, there are a lot of legal problems in a lot of operas. A lot of people get in very bad trouble, and we're going to talk about one of them tonight. So even if you're not an opera lover, I want to tell you a little bit about this because I think it's interesting how something that comes from your world goes through all these different forms and ends up as an opera. And I think it's because, yes, it's an interesting case. Yes, Chester Gillette took Grace Brown out canoeing, and they had a very bad accident one July night in 1906. But it was an incredible sensation in the press. It was the first huge media trial of America. People read about the trial and the case and were fascinated by it. And the reason they were fascinated is actually, it took Theodore Dreiser, I think, to land it when he called it an American tragedy. Because it is not the fact that it was a love triangle, but that it was about class and about the fact that this young, poor boy from the Midwest who came from a religious family, Chester Gillette, went to work at his uncle's factory in Cortland, New York, who was very wealthy. He fell in love with another girl who worked there in the factory with her, with him, and he got her pregnant. And there was a rich socialite girl who he was interested in, and she was interested in him, although later she said they had very limited contact. And it was really about class, because he suddenly was in love with this wealthy girl, and he realized the American dream, he could either try and do it himself by pulling himself up by the bootstraps, or perhaps she was the road to that for him. And that wealth symbolized everything for him. And his way of getting out of a bad predicament was, that's up to you all to decide, because it was only circumstantial evidence. There is nothing about it, and I'm sure, I think you can read about the case there. And so what's fascinating to me is that all of these places are very accessible. Big Moose Lake is a beautiful place to visit. great place to go canoeing and fishing. It's about an hour north of Utica. Then he was tried at the Herkimer Courthouse, which is really a beautiful building that is filled with, you feel that kind of central New York history there. There's a jail underneath it. The courtroom is very simple and honest. And then, of course, he was electrocuted in Auburn, New York. So you can follow that path of history, and that was what enticed Dreiser. He made that path. He then, of course, went back and read every article from 1906 to 1908, and all of Grace Brown's love letters to Chester Gillette, which mostly went unanswered, are actually now available. They are on display this summer at the Fenimore Art Museum, which is in Cooperstown, New York. After Dreiser wrote that novel, as Judith said, it became two great films. Actually, it was an early film in 1929, which is quite touching and moving. But of course, we all know it from A Place in the Sun, Montgomery Clift taking off his clothes for the first time. Hollywood let a guy show his shirt, his bare chest. It was an incredibly popular film, and with good reason. And then Tobias Picker and Gene Shear, composer and librettist, decided that it was the novel, this story of an American tragedy, that would be a worthwhile operatic topic. And so they wrote a work for the Metropolitan Opera. It premiered there in 2008. I directed it. And it was very well received. But in our world, what's funny is that even if an opera is well received, it's hard for it to go on and have another life. It had a great cast. If you're opera goers, it was Susan Graham, Nathan Gunn, Patricia Rosette, and James Conlon conducted. And after doing it, we all felt, the creators felt, that it wasn't quite right, even though it had been well received. And so when I was programming our summer season at Glimmerglass this year, I thought we should go back and visit that opera because it takes place in our backyard in central New York. And I asked the writers to rewrite it, which they have done. They have rewritten a lot of it. They have cut it. They have made it shorter. They have, I think, made it much more dramatic. And that's what we get to do, is we get to take dramatic license. You have to deal with the facts. We have to deal with taking the facts and making them more theatrical, although sometimes I know the facts are more theatrical than anything we could come up with. So they have rewritten the piece. We have an amazing cast of young artists, young singers, and it will be presented this summer, opening in July, and I hope that you all will come and visit Central New York. And now I'm going to let you hear a little bit of what it sounds like and meet some of the characters. We have three of our young artists. They're called young artists. We have, let's say, more established artists, but also we have something called our young artist program at Glimmerglass, which is 40 young singers. It's kind of like when you all have those interns in the summer, and some of them like get jobs afterwards, and some of them don't. That's what we do in our world too. 1,000 kids apply for these, audition for these 36 positions. So it's probably about the same rate that you all have in a lot of your law firms. So we have 36 of these young artists. They come from Juilliard, Indiana, Cincinnati, Conservatory of Music, all the big schools. And they perform a number of roles with us. And then after that, they go and audition, hopefully, and get jobs in bigger companies afterwards. So what we're going to hear now is a few selections. I'd like to introduce you to all of my colleagues. Come on up here, singers, and our wonderful accompanist. Beth Litwinick, who will sing some of the music of Sandra, the wealthy socialite girl. Vanessa Segan, who will play Roberta, is the character's name, who was Grace Brown, whose situation ends badly. Then this is Dan Kurland, who is accompanist. And then we have over here Christian Bowers, who plays the Clyde Griffiths role. So we are going to start with what we call an I am aria. It's also something that you hear in musical theater. It's where a character introduces themselves, basically, and tells you what's inside of them. And that's always the great thing about opera, is that a character can stand up and, you know, sing for 5 minutes and tell you everything about what's going on, but nobody else actually hears it. So do you want to talk about this first aria of yours when you come on?
Sure.
Can everybody hear okay?
So I'm playing the role of Clyde Griffiths, and this is, Francesca had mentioned they have done revisions. They cut out the entire section of him being in Kansas City and working in the hotel. So we start right in the factory in Lycurgus, and Clyde sees his cousin drive off in this motor car. And at that time, the motor car symbolized everything, the American dream, money, power, and he also happened to have two beautiful women riding in the car with him. And that, for Clyde, is everything that he hopes to achieve. And I have to say that the underwriting within this piece, he always refers back to being back in Kansas City and having to, the hymns and prayers and how his family kind of kept, they were very poor in Kansas City. And Clyde just really wants to be wealthy, and he sees this chance with his rich uncle, with this beautiful girl, Sandra, who can kind of elevate his class, as Francesca said, pick himself up by the bootstraps. So this is his first and entrance aria, a motor car.
A motor car, there he goes. What a car, what a car, what a beautiful car. Burgundy red with wooden trim. What would it feel like being him? Traveling a dinner to dance with friends. The car twists like a smile as the road bends. Arriving, there I go. The hum of the engine still in my veins. A hum that sings what I've always known. My future is bright as polished chrome. About that, my mother. on the mission. When I was young, we'd stand on street corners singing hymns and preach the evils of things like vaudeville. I'm so glad I learned to trust the precious Jesus, Savior, friend, and I know that thou art with me.
And be with me to the end.
I don't mean to keep you.
I'm waiting for a friend. Are you coming?
No, I thought I'd walk around a bit. I'm looking for a new place.
You're moving up fast, but you're Griffiths. The best places are down by the river. It's nice. On weekends, people swim and picnic there.
Do you?
I never learned to swim, but I do love picnics. Here she comes.
By the river, you say, nice to meet you, Miss
Alden, Roberta Alden.
The love story starts there, and you know what happens. We're going to offer you two more selections next. We're going to hear Sandra's aria, which happens several scenes later after he begins seeing Roberta. He's invited to his rich uncle's home, where his friend's niece, Sandra, who's all in the same sort of upper social class, arrives after having visited New York City for the first time. And she sings about New York, and as she sings about this incredibly sophisticated world, Clyde is there, and he falls in love with her. So we'll hear that aria sung by Beth, and then Roberta Alden will come back and sing what's known as the letter aria. And this letter aria is the letters that she writes to Clyde when she is waiting at her home in Utica for him to come and get her, because he promised he would. And she has made her wedding dress, and it's starting not to fit. The letter aria is interestingly based on the text of the real letters of Grace Brown. So first of all, the New York aria.
Sun sets on the sparkle of diamonds.
that's a little preview of what we're offering on the artistic side of this incredible case, which gives us much to think about in the theater. I hope that you will consider coming up and visiting us in Cooperstown, New York. The Glimmerglass Festival offers 45 performances of The Summer of Madame Butterfly, The Great American Musical Carousel, Ariadne and Naxos, and then, of course, An American Tragedy. The singers this summer include Christine Gerke, Ryan McKinney, Yuna Lee, really some of America's greatest young artists right now, and more important artists are singing there. We have concerts this summer with Jesse Norman, Christine Gerke, and also, as I mentioned, there will be a special concert which Justice Ginsburg will basically moderate and talk about opera and law. We also have concerts and cabarets. There's the amazing Omegang Brewery. There's the Baseball Hall of Fame. There's Incredible Beauty. There's 18 golf courses and about 8 million tennis courts. There's great fly fishing. Come and visit us. I want to thank so much all of you for being here today, and especially to our hosts. Thank you so much, Susan, for having us, and thank you so much, Judith, for having us, and to let us be in this incredibly august building. What an amazing building. Thank you so much for sharing it with all of us and for having us here. I think I'm going to just ask quickly if there are any questions, or yes, let's just, any questions that I might answer for the audience here? Yes, sir, or repeat them.
I don't know if you can reveal this. Is the boat at the trial?
Yeah, is the boat at the trial the way it was historically? Yes. You know, it's funny. They brought the boat into the courtroom, when you go to the courtroom in Herkimer, you go like, how could they have gotten that boat through that door? It's so small. Yes, the boat appears in the courtroom. And of course, what's amazing is that he took his suitcase and his tennis racket on the boat. I always think, how did he explain why he had his tennis racket out there on the boat with him? But yes, we do. And we, you know, do it. The drowning is part of the opera. And that's very difficult to realize without having real water. So it's done. There's a whole drowning music theme which runs through the piece. And so we do the drowning. Yes. Yes, sir. Did the socialite, no, the question is, did the socialite actually visit Clyde Griffiths? No, but Dreiser, of course, created the fact that she came, that his character, Sandra, came to visit him in his prison cell in Herkimer and then in Cortland. I mean, Herkimer be small, the cell is really teeny. Cortland, I mean, the prison still stands. It's been repurposed into another building, but... historically, she did not. Historically, there's even a lot of question about how much time he really spent with her. But again, it makes great theater. Yes, in the back.
His wife is so complicated to get.
Why is it so complicated to get from Cooperstown? Sounds like you've been there. Okay, it's not that complicated. Call me. Okay, all right, okay. Very briefly, staying within the state law speed limit, you can get from New York City to Cooperstown in 3.5 hours. You can take the train to Albany, and then there is a bus service or driver or rent a car. There's a trolley. Oh, no, it services all of our performances. I've been there 4 years. It services them now better. I'm on it. Okay? All right. And if you have any problem, call me. Okay? All right. Okay. I want you to get there. Talk to me afterwards. Yes?
How long is this opera?
How long is the opera? That's a really good question. Because it's a revised version, we don't know yet. It was 3 hours. They've cut probably, it's probably going to be 2.5 hours long. I'm a firm believer, except for Wagner, in operas not lasting more than 3 hours and only having one intermission. I think it's important. Because I know a lot of people, you sit there and you think, boy, I'm never going to make up this time again in my life. I know in this busy world, and I love opera. I mean, except for Wagner, I just, a lot of times, I don't want to sit through it. So, 2.5 hours. Dramatic, fast-paced, good-moving, sexy, handsome cast. He takes his shirt off. Yes.
Which side does the opera come down on?
Which side does the opera come down on? That's a very good question, because in the movie, it is very ambiguous that if he committed murder or not, or if he was unjustly accused. And so the opera makes it pretty clear that he doesn't. The movie doesn't, because the producers didn't want it to be like he was, that Montgomery Clift would be a murderer. So that's why they made the director change the Dreiser. The same thing happened to Alfred Hitchcock with The Great Knot when he made the film of Rebecca, which is another great case, where basically Hitchcock was like, well, wait a minute, in the novel, it's like clear he kills her. And they said, there is no way that he is going to be appearing to be murdering poor Joan Crawford. I mean, it's really interesting how Hollywood has twisted the law, right? Okay? Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you so much for having us. It's been a pleasure.
I think you'll agree with me that that is the proverbial tough act to follow. I think one of the main reasons that I'm here is that the Bar Association won't actually give those of you who are lawyers CLE credits for watching opera. And I think that the title of this program suggests that maybe that actually is a mistake. I mean, the whole idea of law and the arts, you know, you're all here because you're interested in law and you're interested in the arts. And one of the things that I want to talk about is that actually there are connections between law and literature in particular. So I want to start by giving you a little bit more background on the actual case, because I think at this point, when you think about the triangle of the American tragedy, how many of you have seen A Place in the Sun? Okay, so you're visualizing, even if you read the Dreiser, you're visualizing Montgomery Clift and Elizabeth Taylor and Shelley Winters, the poor thing. How do you compete with Elizabeth Taylor? So I want to get back to the original trial, because now, you know, except for those of you who have studied the case, I know some of you have. How many people have actually studied the case? Okay, so you know, please add. Feel free to add and things if there are things that I'm leaving out. But let me go back to the Gillette trial itself, which recently had its 100th anniversary. So Chester Gillette, as you've heard, was a poor boy who had a rich uncle, and he was working at his rich uncle's factory, a skirt factory in upstate New York, Cortland, and he was more than Clyde Griffiths in Dreiser's book, he was a little better educated. He had been to prep school, and he was something of a playboy, and he fancied himself as being very good with the ladies. And clearly, you've already been introduced to the idea that there was something going on about class. You heard the wonderful song about Clyde Griffiths falling in love with motor cars and really wanting the American dream to be his. And working for his wealthy uncle, and sort of rubbing elbows with the wealthy uncle and the family in Cortland, seemed to him to possibly be a way in which he could ascend to an upper class. So there's definitely, as Francesca was saying, a very important element of class in this whole situation. However, the class issue, I think, goes both ways, because while Chester is hoping to rise above, having grown up as a very poor boy, I think Grace Brown, who he meets in the factory, that's the original name of the woman who he meets, Chester and Grace, as opposed to Clyde and Roberta, who you've been hearing about, and if there's any confusion, I'll go over that again. Because it's hard to keep the names straight, and then the names are again different in A Place in the Sun for reasons I'll explain. So when Grace meets Chester, it seems very likely that she thinks of him as the wealthy boss's rich nephew, even though he himself is not rich. So Chester probably looks to her like her ticket to upward mobility. And so when the affair continues and she becomes pregnant, she is extremely eager for many reasons to have Chester marry her. Chester is reluctant at that point, and he's very sorry that he's involved with her, and he, at this point, he would much rather be hanging out with wealthier people, and he doesn't want to be dragged down in this way. So what ends up happening is they do, as you've already heard, they end up going off on this trip, which Grace certainly believes is to be their wedding trip, that he's taking her off to do the right thing by her and marry her, but ends up in the rowboat on Big Moose Lake, where she ends up drowning. Now, Chester is tried for murder, but I think one thing that we really still do not know about the actual case, and I would argue also about Dreiser's version of the same similar story, is whether Chester in fact did murder Grace. They were in the rowboat. She did drown. And there's enough of evidence of different sorts that, you know, that certainly the prosecution was able to convince a jury that this was a murder. But it's not clear whether or not this was actually a murder, whether it was an accident, or whether, you know, the third possibility, which is pretty distant, is whether this was a suicide. So what happened was that Chester Gillette was not very smart, I think, and he really did himself in by, as soon as suspicion focused on him, he started to lie. So when the question came up of had he been in the rowboat on the lake and had he been involved in this, at first he denied it. He hadn't been there at all. You know, it must have been somebody else. Witnesses came forward and identified the fact that, you know, he identified him as having been there. So when it was clear that he could no longer argue that he hadn't been in the rowboat at all, he started to argue that the whole thing had been an accident. And here the facts started to trip him up because, you know, why did he have his tennis racket and his suitcase? He and Grace had checked into this lodge. He used a false name checking into the lodge. And it seemed that he had a date with some wealthy people to hang out right after going off with Grace in the rowboat, so it seems that he really had no intention of marrying her. And he said at one point, well, he had put the suitcase and the tennis racket on shore, and that was why they were dry later, and that's, you know, they hadn't fallen into the lake. And the stories just kept contradicting each other. So he was doing, you know, one of the most foolish things that you can do, as we now know in our post-Miranda days. He was trying to talk his way out of the situation by just saying anything that seemed convenient at the time. Okay, so that's part of the background here, that he's lying a great deal. So by the time he finishes, he's gotten past, he can't say he wasn't there. He's having a hard time arguing that it was an accident because of this whole business about the dry suitcase and everything else. So at the trial, what he actually testifies is that Grace committed suicide. Now, if you look at the transcript, if you don't pay any attention to all the lies and everything else, in the letters that Grace has written, there's a lot where she does say, it would be better if I were dead. And, you know, there are things that are not completely inconsistent with that, but probably in all likelihood, this was not his best defense. So, as I guess Judge Kaye was saying, all of the evidence at this trial was circumstantial. And if you think about it, here's a really interesting thing about law and literature. In homicide trials, how do we find out what the facts are? Unless you have an eyewitness or, you know, some really smoking gun, the two people who know what happened are the decedent, who can't tell us what happened, and the defendant, who has a Fifth Amendment privilege not to tell us what happened and has a lot of self-interest in possibly telling us not the correct version of what happened. So when you look at it, trials are a really difficult thing because in homicide cases, what really matters is what was going on inside the defendant's head. And if you can't find that out, how do you know? So juries find facts, we say. They have to decide what the facts are. You know, the facts, as we all know, don't just come to us in a can that we can pick up in the market. In literature, on the other hand, when Dreiser tells the story, there is truth. We can be inside the defendant's mind, and we can see what is happening. So I think one very interesting comparison between law and literature is this whole idea that in trials, we find facts. We don't really know what the truth is. We have a search for truth. And it's sometimes hard to be certain that we've found it, even after a conviction, even after an appeal. But in literature, if the author tells you this is what the defendant was thinking, then you know what the defendant was thinking, and you know the truth, and then you can judge the system accordingly by whether the system actually reached the correct result. So what happened in the trial was that the prosecution, if this was a very lengthy trial, as you've heard, it was, you know, a big media trial. There were 1,000 spectators. Well, there were 83 witnesses. The prosecution seems to have called everybody who Chester Gillette and Grace Brown had ever met, and everybody had something to say about their relationship, but it was all just circumstantial. So in addition, you think about what the prosecutor has so far. Chester Gillette certainly had the motive to kill Grace Brown, right? He didn't want to marry her. He did want to be free to hang out in different social circles. He certainly had the opportunity. He was there in the rowboat when she did, in fact, drown. There is some evidence of premeditation that the witnesses are able to supply the prosecution with, including that Chester had checked them into the lodge under false names. A couple of other, the fact that he had a date right afterwards. It sounds like, you know, he had in fact been premeditating, had been thinking of killing her. So in addition to this evidence of premeditation, the prosecution then added forensic evidence. The prosecutor's theory was that Chester Gillette had hit Grace Brown in the head with his tennis racket, you know, hard enough to perhaps kill her, and that then she fell overboard from the blow. But that, you know, she had not just drowned, that it couldn't have been a suicide, as his theory was, because he had hit her in the head with a tennis racket. So the prosecution called 5 doctors to testify about the forensic evidence. Now, the doctors testified that about the blow on the head, but the problem with the autopsy was that they embalmed the body before doing the autopsy. Now, I haven't been watching CSI that much, but you know, I gather some of you have, because you know that's not a really good idea. Evidently, it interferes with the accuracy of the results. So, you know, all these things that the doctors were saying, you know, maybe, maybe not. So they're all testifying, and they're saying, you know, 5 different prosecution doctors are saying, oh, yes, she was hit in the head, and that's what killed her. Well, on cross-examination, Chester Gillette's lawyers, who actually did a pretty good job, were able to bring out the fact that there was actually a certain amount of evidence showing that Grace Brown might have died. You know, this is about water as opposed to air in your lungs and so forth. That she might have died by drowning as opposed to by, from the blow on the head. And the defense counsel also managed to elicit during the cross-examination that the doctors had agreed beforehand that they didn't want to bring that up because that would just muddy the waters. It was, you know, just that they would all just testify that, yes, she had been hit, and that was what they were going to tell. So, you know, so far so good for the defense. Only circumstantial evidence, motive, opportunity, yes, some sign of premeditation. Then I think one of the major factors that is injected into the trial are Grace Brown's letters. Now, you just heard Vanessa sing one of Grace Brown's letters. And many, many letters were introduced. And the trial judge, who had only been on the bench for a year, decided to admit the letters. And he admitted the letters on the very interesting theory that the letters would show how the decedent felt about the defendant, but that they would not be appropriate for any other reason, and that therefore he was going to tell the jury just only to consider them, not for the truth of anything in the letters, of course, but you know, to just limit their consideration to what the letters showed about the relationship. So many, many letters were read. To give you an idea of the media circus around this trial, copies of Grace Brown's letters were being sold out on the street outside the trial. You could buy the letters and take them home and read them. Well, when you think about what's going on there, we all know that law, like in literature, narrative plays a very central role. Every trial, you all know, is telling the jury stories. It's all about narrative. So you think about the narratives that the jury is getting here from the two different characters. As to Grace Brown, they have all these letters written in her own voice where she's explaining how anxious she is, how much she wants Chester to marry her, you know, how upset she is about everything, how hopeful she is, or, you know, just gossip, you know, everything in her letters. You really get to know her as a person. What does the jury get to know about Chester Gillette? That he lied consistently because he's cross-examined for a very long time, and the prosecutor does quite a good job of establishing that he's been lying his head off about everything. So once the jury has concluded that he's been shown to be a liar about many things, why not conclude equally that he's been lying about everything and that he did kill her, despite what he says? Now, in addition to our narratives that the jury gets to know Grace a lot better than they get to know Chester, the jurors are all local farmers, and therefore Grace is going to seem a lot more familiar to them. And to them, too, as to Grace, Chester probably seems like, you know, the upper class. You know, he's related to the rich uncle and so forth. So it takes, at the end of the trial, it takes the jury about 5 hours to convict Chester Gillette. You've already heard about the boat being dragged into the courtroom. The cross-examination of Chester Gillette went on forever. They try to reenact the whole scene in the courtroom. And one other mistake that Chester Gillette makes is that he is sitting through the whole trial just stone-faced. He's not showing any emotion at all. And in fact, witnesses have also been able to establish that after Grace Brown's death by drowning, however it happened, accident, suicide, murder, Chester just went on with his life. He showed no indication that anything significant had happened, and he's just sort of pretending like it all didn't happen. And then he's sitting in court, showing no grief, you know, no remorse or whatever might be appropriate, no emotion at all. So Chester Gillette later said that he was in fact feeling a lot of emotion, but he was hiding it because he just thought that that was the right thing to do. You know, he was just, you know, not trying to show emotion. So, you know, not surprising when you look at the whole situation that the jury did convict him. Was Chester guilty? Yeah, I think it's not entirely clear, you know, what happened in this boat because, again, you know, Chester was not really giving an entire account of what happened. But it is possible that even though he premeditated killing Grace Brown, it's possible that he didn't. It's possible that there was some sort of accident. But there's really nothing in the trial transcript to enable you to figure that out. there was a song after the trial that was quite popular. This trial was a really big deal in the media. And the song said that only God and Gillette knew if he was guilty. There was a publisher who had a contest offering a reward of $500 for the person who had the best analysis of whether or not Chester Gillette was really guilty. So yeah, there remained some doubt in people's minds, because this is very unusual to have a homicide conviction on the basis only of circumstantial evidence. No confession, et cetera. So in addition to the whole question of whether Chester Gillette was guilty, another question, of course, that arises in the minds of lawyers immediately is, did he have a fair trial? Well, you know, his defense lawyers were pretty good. There was not much that they could do with a client who was not credible because he had been lying so much. The Court of Appeals, in the decision that you could read that's in your materials here, upheld the conviction. And the court thought that the most difficult question was whether or not Grace Brown's letters should have been admitted. And the court came up with what I thought was really actually a very strange analysis. They said, well, you know, it wasn't really appropriate for the judge to admit these letters to explain the relationship of the decedent and the defendant, but it would have been appropriate going to motive. The prosecutors read a lot of parts of the letters, however, that had nothing to do with motive. They were just, as the court said, girlish, gossip, and expressions of endearment, and all sorts of other things about what Grace Brown was thinking. But the Court of Appeals said, the defense didn't object to the reading of those other parts of the letters. Now, to me, you know, as a lawyer, this is a little bit odd. You know, why should the defense have to object to the reading of more of the letters? Why doesn't the prosecution have to explain why they can read the parts of the letters that they read? So the reading of Grace Brown's letters was very important. It was a major thing that the court looked at. And the court said, and here, you know, see what you think of this. The court says, well, how would the jury really be affected by Grace Brown's girlish gossip and expressions of endearment? Okay, so, you know, easy to say, but not so clear that the jury would not have been affected. So that was one of the big issues on appeal. A second issue was that in his opening statement, the district attorney tried to portray Grace as just, you know, a complete innocent. And one of the things that he said, consistently with this line, because Grace, we know, was a fallen woman. She, in fact, had engaged in extramarital sex. So what the prosecutor said in his opening, for which there was absolutely no evidence, was that Chester Gillette had raped her. Because that was, of course, the explanation, if she was so innocent, that it must have been that he had raped her. Well, the judge, because there was no evidence of this, instructed the jury not to consider that. Okay, so there you are, there's number two. Number three, the prosecution also thought that because Grace had been pregnant, it would be quite significant to introduce to the jury the fetus. So they bring the fetus into the courtroom. The judge, to his credit, said, no, you cannot properly label the fetus as an exhibit. So you know, the judge gets that one right, but there's still, you know, a little dicey going on. Finally, there was a tremendous amount of pretrial publicity. And here I think you have to give this judge, Judge Devendorf, who'd only been on the bench for a year, a lot of credit, because in 1906, he understood the problem of pretrial publicity. And he instructed the jurors, he questioned them, instructed them not to read anything, and made sure that they didn't get news reports about the trial while they were sitting. So you know, there was one that he really kind of pulled out of the fire. One more thing that I want to tell you about the defense summation, because I think this sets up an interesting comparison to the Dreiser book. You've already heard mentioned the idea that we don't really know whether or not Chester and Grace ever sought the possibility of an abortion. Well, the defense counsel made something of that at the trial. There's really no mention of abortion at the trial, except the defense attorney said to the jury in summation that at least Chester and Grace had not has not sought the aid of a criminal, because abortion at that point in New York was against the law. So he was trying to make this a plus, that you know, that they had not sought the aid of a criminal. So that's the basic Gillette trial. That's sort of the short version. The record itself is not short. The record on appeal was some 3,000 pages. It was like the longest record ever. There's a massive amount of information. On the question of whether or not Dreiser was guilty, I want to tell you one more thing, which is very interesting. On the 75th anniversary of the trial, there's a man named Craig Brandon who was sniffing around and doing some reporting and discovered that nobody had ever written a book on the Gillette trial, even though it had been such an incredible big deal at the time. So he decided to write a book, which he did, a quite interesting book called Murder in the Adirondacks. And he went around and interviewed all sorts of people, and he came up with somebody who had not testified at the trial. And the witness who he came up with had been at the time a 13-year-old boy who told him that when the local people were searching the lake for Grace Brown's body, they used a long pole where they were, you know, sticking around to try to see if they could find the body, and that according to the boy, that long pole really could have explained the marks on Grace Brown's, you know, face, which, you know, had been taken by the prosecution to show that Chester Gillette must have hit her with a tennis racket. When Mr. Brandon then interviewed Mr. Ward, who had been the district attorney, Ward said, ooh, if the jury had heard that, they would have acquitted him. So, you know, this was kind of a counter to the circumstantial evidence, and the jury put this story together that he must have hit her with the tennis racket because motive, opportunity, premeditation, he's lying, we don't like him, we like her, and there it was. Okay, now I want to get to Theodore Dreiser. And I want to focus mostly on what he changed in the story and how, what that can tell us about law and literature. Now, first of all, Dreiser had been telling his friends for a while before he wrote An American Tragedy that he wanted to get inside the mind of a murderer. He thought that would be an interesting thing to do. And he particularly thought that this triangle plot, a poor boy who murders a poor girl because he wants to be with a rich girl, was an amazing American plot, a kind of typical American plot, which he said just has everything. He says it has it all, politics, society, religion, business, sex. So he decided that he was just going to look for these cases. He claimed at one point that he had found as many as a dozen just looking around the country, although some people think that may have been an exaggeration. And he was saying that he was kind of putting together a composite of these cases and that he wasn't only just reproducing the Gillette cases, the Gillette case. However, the Gillette case was clearly his main case. You've just heard Vanessa sing one of Grace Brown's letters. That was Grace Brown's letter. That was not something that Theodore Dreiser wrote. And in his book, he used word for word many of Grace Brown's letters. His main character, Clyde Griffiths, he renamed. You notice the similarity? He's kept the initials, the CG, Clyde Griffiths, Chester Gillette. So he's changed the names. The other thing that he's changed is that in the original Chester Gillette trial, there was a Miss X, and there was talk about whether or not Miss X was in fact somebody who Chester Gillette wanted to marry. She was kept out of the trial. She never testified. But it doesn't seem that there was a real triangle going on there. He doesn't seem to have been engaged to somebody. So the close relationship that Dreiser described and that you saw in A Place in the Sun with Elizabeth Taylor visiting, you know, Montgomery Clift in prison and she truly loved him, doesn't seem to have happened in real life. So clearly Dreiser was sharpening the triangle and he was just making it much more of a classic triangle. Now I think that somebody was just asking Francesca the question of, well, do you portray the Clyde as being guilty? I think that Dreiser was intending to leave that question to the reader, like Shakespeare, like Melville. I think he's trying to give you enough information so you can decide for yourself whether or not his character is guilty. And he changes a number of things to try to tip the scales enough that you are willing to think about whether or not Clyde is really guilty. Number one, and this is sort of one of his main arguments, a theory that he's sort of putting forward. One of the reasons that Dreiser is interested in this and thinks that this is an American tragedy is because of the role of the American dream. That, you know, Chester slash Clyde is somebody who really wants, he loves the beautiful cars and he wants to be rich. The book is 850 pages, and some people have said it's inexorable. All of book one is Clyde's early life, and you see him being poor. You see him working in a hotel with rich people and seeing the fancy motor cars and envying that life. And Dreiser, I think, is making an argument that there may have been just a lot of determinism in this, and that Clyde Griffith may have been a victim. Clyde Griffith is not exactly Chester Gillette. And one thing that's interesting is that Dreiser has given Clyde Griffith parts of his own life. He's given Clyde a religious fanatic parent, whereas he had a religious fanatic for a mother. Theodore Dreiser himself ditched a small town wife in order to go live the good bohemian life in Greenwich Village when he became famous. There's an account in the book at one place of a pretty woman who was seduced and abandoned by an upper class cad. That was one of Dreiser's sisters. So there's a lot going on in the book where Dreiser is really kind of putting in his own life and really reflecting on this whole question of whether you could think of Clyde Griffiths, his version of the Chester Gillette character, as a victim. Part of what I think Dreiser is doing is to give you this whole context, and what people were just saying, Francesca was saying that the opera only just goes for the drama at the end, and of course can't include all of book one and book two of, you know, who was Clyde. So you get the introductory aria where we know he loves the fancy cars, but not the whole story of his religious parents and his upbringing and whether he was somehow also made a victim. Well, Clyde, as I mentioned, is also, he's less well-educated than Chester Gillette. And he's placed in this situation with a rich uncle who's not altogether welcoming of him. One of the things that Dreiser changes, which I think is extremely interesting in terms of the facts that he changes just to sharpen his point, is the factory that the uncle runs becomes a collar factory. Okay, you all know about collars? Okay, poorer people could buy a fresh collar to put on their frayed shirt so it looked good. And they really didn't have a shirt, you know, a nice shirt underneath. But it's the illusion of respectability, right? A cheap way for people in the lower classes to look upper class. Significant, right? He didn't want a skirt factory, he wanted a collar factory. As opposed to, I think in the book, it was a bathing suit factory. So everybody got to model the bathing suits. So that's one change. Another big change in the book is that Dreiser has a scene where Chester and Grace do seek the help of an abortion doctor. And as I said, abortion was illegal in New York at the time, so they weren't supposed to be there, but in fact, you know, Clyde leans on Roberta, the Grace character, to agree to consider an abortion. So they go to the abortion doctor, and the abortion doctor gives them a long lecture about how abortion is illegal in New York. Okay, what's Dreiser's point? Rich people are gonna get their abortions, poor people are not. I had a couple who I know went to see An American Tragedy when it was at the Met, and the woman said to her husband, wow, you know, this is really a story about availability of abortion, isn't it? And he said, no, it isn't. So, you know, so there it is. So Dreiser takes that one on too, but it, again, it becomes part of his story about class, that, you know, the fact that there was no way out of abortion was something that does seem to have been more limited to the poorer classes as opposed to the wealthier classes who would have had a way out. The next thing that Dreiser does is he furnishes Clyde, his version of Chester, with explanations, first of all for his lies. And his explanation that he tells us is that Clyde is just terrified, he panics. And when people accuse him of something, he just starts saying things, that he's just so anxious. And in Dreiser's version of what's going on in Clyde's mind and how he just, you know, he just can't keep it together enough to not tell lies, I see sort of early recognitions of Miranda. You know, you tell people they don't have to testify, not just so that guilty people won't confess, but so that innocent people won't start making things up to try to get out of it because they think they can talk their way out of it. So that is Dreiser's explanation that he gives us. You know, maybe it's all true, that Clyde Griffiths tells us that what happened was, yes, he had the motive, yes, he had the opportunity, yes, he premeditated, but when it came right down to it in the rowboat in the lake, he couldn't do it. And in fact, what happened was an accident. So the accident that happened in Dreiser's portrayal is that what Clyde has with him in the boat is not a tennis racket, but a camera. And in the explanation that Dreiser gives, Clyde is sitting there struggling with whether or not he's actually gonna kill Grace. Roberta. He's thought about this, but he can't do it at the last minute. And let me read you Dreiser's description of this, because according to Dreiser, very complex, it's not just intent, yes or no. So he says, at this cataclysmic moment and in the face of the most urgent need of action, a sudden palsy of the will, of courage, of hate or rage sufficient, and with Roberta from her seat in the stern of the boat gazing at his troubled and then suddenly distorted and fulgurous, yet weak and even unbalanced face, a face of a sudden, instead of angry, ferocious, demoniac, confused and all but meaningless in its registration, of a balanced combat between fear, a chemic revulsion against death or murderous brutality that would bring death, and a harried and restless and yet self-repressed desire to do, yet temporarily unbreakable here and now, a static between a powerful compulsion to do and yet not to do. So Clyde is struggling in his mind. It's not clear what he's gonna do. And at that point, Roberta, seeing that he looks rather odd, stands up and comes toward him, meaning to take his hand. And we're told, Clyde reflexively, as she drew near him, seeking to take his hand in hers and the camera from him in order to put it in the boat, he flinging out at her, but but not even then with any intention to do other than free himself of her touch, her pleading, consoling sympathy, her presence forever, God. Yet the camera still unconsciously held tight, pushing at her with so much vehemence as to not only to strike her lips and nose and chin with it, but to throw her back sidewise onto the left whale, which caused the boat to careen to the very water's edge. Okay, so in Dreiser's explanation, complicated thoughts going on in Clyde's mind, but Clyde doesn't think that he has killed her. He doesn't think he intended to do so. And as he's swimming, after the boat capsizes, she's in the water, he's in the water, they're swimming, and he's thinking, well, I didn't intend to kill her. The next question becomes, is he going to save her? One very interesting fact is that Roberta cannot swim, like Grace. So Clyde is in the water, and he's again having complicated thoughts. I won't read you his mental processes here, but he's thinking all sorts of things, one of which is, if I go to her, maybe she'll drown me, maybe she'll pull me down. And all sorts of complicated thoughts, and he does not rescue her. Now, the judge in the Chester Gillette trial quite properly charged the jury that when Grace Brown was in that same situation, that Chester had no legal duty to rescue Grace. It was an omission. No legal duty, and therefore he could not be found guilty of homicide for not rescuing her. Okay, so legally, the question of whether Chester Gillette was guilty didn't hinge on that. The question of whether Clyde Griffith is guilty doesn't hinge on whether or not he failed to rescue her. It depends on all this complicated stuff that's going on in his mind. He's thinking every which way. So, you know, only God and Gillette know. It seems that not even Gillette knew, you know, in Dreiser's telling whether or not he was guilty. He couldn't tell. Did he mean it? So he reflects on this a lot over time, of did he, in fact, while he was pushing the camera, was there something subconscious that made his blow a little harder? He doesn't know. So in the article that is in your materials for tonight, the Tennessee Law Review article, one claim is that what Dreiser is doing here is, in addition to looking at the American dream and the American tragedy, he's also critiquing American law and its focus on intentionalism. How do you figure that out? If Clyde Griffiths himself couldn't figure out what was going on, how in the world is the jury supposed to figure out which thing was happening in his mind? Okay, so I think that Dreiser is not trying to make all this simple for us in terms of guilt, and I think one thing that Dreiser is telling us, and that he has his characters go through, and this is something Chester Gillette also went through, is that the question of moral guilt is really a much more interesting question than the question of legal guilt. So Chester Gillette, after, you know, while he was in Auburn, has something of a religious conversion, and he confesses at one point, there's a point where he says, oh yes, I did it, I did mean, I killed her. But it's not clear even then, especially in Dreiser's telling, when Clyde Griffiths confesses and has his moment of religion and owns what he did, it's not clear whether he's right, whether it's just his conscience gnawing at him. So I think that Dreiser is very much putting to us that we have to decide this and that we are, in effect, the jury, but a different kind of jury because we're a jury to literature as opposed to a trial. Now, the other thing that Dreiser has also done to also kind of stack the deck a little bit to make us willing to see Clyde Griffith's and Chester Gillette's side of the story is he has made the trial more blatantly unfair. There is, in Dreiser's telling, there is a member of the prosecution team who falsifies evidence. They don't have enough circumstantial evidence, and a member of the prosecution actually takes the camera with which Grace Brown was struck, we believe, and takes hair from the decedent and puts her hair on the camera. Okay, pretty bad, right? Okay, so Dreiser is giving us that. He's making this really quite bad. A second thing of that Dreiser has changed about the trial, which again, very much about class, very interesting, is that in the book, Clyde Griffiths gets a lawyer who's paid for by his rich uncle. He can't afford to hire a lawyer, so his rich uncle hires the lawyer. He who hires the lawyer calls the shots, according to Dreiser. So the rich uncle says to the lawyer, okay, here are the ground rules. No pleas of insanity, that would be too embarrassing. No family visits, we don't want Clyde's mother because, you know, she's the poor relations, she's too embarrassing, we're just gonna leave this to us, leave her, you know, we don't want the mother in the courtroom. And finally, Miss X, the wealthy woman who you might have liked to shed on this, shouldn't be involved. If she's from a good family, they should just be able to stay out of this. So don't call her as a witness. And furthermore, if you lose, you know, that's it. I'll pay for the trial, but if he's convicted, no appeal. Okay, so the uncle is really calling the shots here. In the actual Chester Gillette trial, here's another interesting fact about New York legal history. New York very early on had a right to counsel for people who couldn't afford counsel. Chester Gillette's uncle did not pay for his lawyer. Chester Gillette had lawyers assigned by the court, and they were quite good. They were very prominent lawyers, Mr. Belknap, et cetera. So I think that's also very interesting that Dreiser wanted to change that to really give us something to sink our teeth into about how this was all unfair. An additional thing that Dreiser changes is that Mr. Ward, the DA in the Gillette case, was somebody who was, in fact, he had to be elected, and so there were partisan politics going on. And Dreiser really makes a lot of that in the book, that there were partisan politics and that Ward is running for re-election on the basis of what's happening in this case. What actually happened in the Gillette case was that Mr. Ward had been elected, he had been re-elected a week before the trial started. So that really was not a factor. Okay, so some very significant differences that I think, you know, Dreiser is changing the story in order to enable us to just step back and take a different look at the American tragedy. What is the tragedy here? Well, both in prison, we know that Chester Gillette, one of the things that he was reading was this rags to riches fantasy called Ishmael, you know, very Alger, you know, Horatio Alger, etc. Dreiser changes that too. What Clyde Griffiths reads while he's in prison is the Arabian Nights. And throughout the book, there's a whole Arabian Nights motif. And I think that what Theodore Dreiser is telling us that is that Clyde Griffiths, no more than Chester Gillette, just didn't realize that it wasn't going to happen, that there is no way to jump the class barrier, and that the American dream is really not so easily achieved, and that it has this dark side. And the dark side is the American tragedy of how Clyde was conditioned to want the motor cars and this high life that he could get close to, had never quite grasped, and therefore was tempted, perhaps, perhaps not, to commit murder in order to try to achieve. Now, the religious conversions of each, also another very interesting question, are they getting back to the religious roots of their parents, et cetera? Another interesting part of the book, comments on religion. Now, I just want to tell you about one last name change that Dreiser came up with. The actual town in upstate New York where this took place was Cortland, but we all know in upstate New York there are a lot of classical names, right? Troy and Ithaca and Rome. Well, what Dreiser calls the town, he changes the name to Lycurgus, L-Y-C-U-R-G-U-S. Okay, how many people, not Barry, have ever heard of Lycurgus? Okay, just three. Okay, Plutarch's Lives. Lycurgus was a member of two royal families of Sparta. He was descended from Hercules. And two royal families, so he has his father and then his older brother before him in succession to the throne. Well, his father and the brother both die. So at this point, Lycurgus could get to be king, except his brother has left a widow and the widow is pregnant. So the widow comes to Lycurgus and says, here's a good idea. How about if I have an abortion and you marry me and we'll rule together? Well, Lycurgus doesn't really approve of abortions. He does not actually think this is a good idea, but he pretends to play along. And he says to his widowed sister-in-law, he says, well, okay, you know, you're right, we have to get rid of the children, but an abortion might really be harmful to your health. And therefore, what we really should do is when the baby is born, you know, I'll take care of disposing of the baby. But really what he does is he gives secret orders that the baby should be brought to him and kept safe. So the baby is born, and the baby is a boy. And therefore, the baby is now the heir to the throne. And the baby is named Charilaus, meaning joy of the people. And when Lycurgus receives the baby, he puts the baby essentially on the throne. He gives the baby the seat of honor and says to everyone, here's the new king. Yeah, I'm happy to be regent and help to rule while he's still too little to rule, but this is the king. Okay, well, the sister-in-law is not happy with this. So she starts spreading rumors, and she spreads rumors including that Lycurgus intends to kill Charilaus and that he's been plotting to kill the king, when really quite the opposite. Well, Lycurgus realizes that you really can't fight public opinion. And he realizes that this rumor has become so prevalent that if anything ever happens to the baby king, he is going to be blamed and he's going to be considered a murderer. So he decides to get out of town. So he goes off to Crete and he goes off to different places and he's studying how to run a really good government and he's studying enlightened theory and so forth. Well, eventually the people of Sparta decide that this baby and whoever is really in charge is not such a good king. So they ask Lycurgus to come back. So Lycurgus comes back, and what does Lycurgus do when he comes back? He attacks the inequality in Spartan society. He's very upset that, you know, so much of the land is owned by so few of the people. So at first, he knows he can't go too fast too soon. So at first, he does things like require everybody to eat meals together in a mess hall, so everybody's eating the same things, and he thinks, you know, maybe money is less important if you all have to eat the same meals anyway. And gradually, he works up to prohibiting, just banning gold and silver, and he creates a more equitable society. Why did Dreiser name this town Lycurgus? It's all there, right? The uncle and the nephew, the abortion that didn't happen, the class issues. It's amazing that he found that name. So I leave you with Lycurgus. I'll just tell you two more things. First, stranger than fiction, but true. There are things in Dreiser's book that are quite unbelievable. You can't believe he didn't make them up, but he didn't. Chester Gillette's mother, like Clyde Griffith's mother, worked for a newspaper covering the trial of her son. And that's how she got to attend the trial. She was their reporter at the trial. Bizarre. Chester Gillette sold photographs of himself to people outside the courtroom, make a little money. Okay, it's in the book. You know, you couldn't believe it if you didn't see it there. So I think that's about what I want to tell you about the book itself. Now I just want to tell you one more thing before we open this up to discussion, questions, and whatever for Francesca as well as for me. There were two sequels involving law and literature to the writing of Dreiser's book. The first one involved the book being banned in Boston. You've all heard of banned in Boston? Well, this one was banned in Boston because the book was said to be obscene, indecent, and impure. So there's an appeal called Commonwealth versus Freed from 1930, telling about what happened at this trial when the book is banned in Boston. So the prosecutor reads excerpts of the book to the jury. It reminds me of Grace Brown's letters, right? The prosecutor's reading excerpts of the parts he doesn't like, the parts that are indecent and obscene to the jury. So the defense counsel says, okay, well, I want to read some other parts to give you some context so you can understand what the story is all about. The trial judge says, no, you can't do that. That's actually a problem. There's too much of the book for you to read all of the context. And if you don't read it all, then you're being subjective and just picking some out. So no, you know, just the context doesn't really matter. So is this ironic? I mean, the reason that Dreiser wrote this book was to give context to the Gillette story. So there's interesting story number one. Interesting story number two is Judge Kaye said there have sort of been three films of this story. Well, Paramount, there had been a play first based on an American Tragedy. Paramount then had the rights to make the first film, and who they hired to write the script was Sergei Eisenstein, the great Russian filmmaker, right? So this is pretty interesting. Well, guess what Eisenstein decided to do with this story? Right back in 1930, he decided to make it an indictment of American materialism and capitalism. Okay, so Paramount gets his script and they don't like it. So they bury that one. So the next thing that they do is they hire Joseph von Sternberg. And von Sternberg actually makes a film in 1931 called An American Tragedy. And he directs it and he has somebody else working with him on the script. Well, the script is pulling in the other direction. Paramount clearly doesn't want to write something that's against the American dream. So Dreiser hates the film. So he sues Paramount to try to get the film enjoined. He doesn't want the film shown because it's just not what he intended. So Paramount's defense, when Dreiser says, well, wait a minute, you changed my story. Paramount's defense is, this isn't your story, this is the Gillette case. You just plagiarized the Gillette case. Look, they're all Grace Brown's letters. You know, what do you mean we can't change your story? This isn't your, you know, you didn't create this. Well, ends up Dreiser loses. The film is released, and you can still see that around today. Very interesting old black and white film called An American Tragedy. Then about 20, well, let me tell you the other part in between. So another person who we now need to meet is Minerva Brown, Grace Brown's mother, who is very upset after she sees this film about the fact that the Brown family is being portrayed as dirty and illiterate and really just, you know, not very attractive people. So she sues Paramount for the portrayal, and what's interesting was that in her lawsuit, they totally confuse what's in the book and what's in the movie. You know, she sues Paramount, but a lot of what she's talking about was in Dreiser's book. And Dreiser, in fact, has laid on a little bit, you know, what he's talking about. So ironically enough, Paramount's defense this time to the libel suit that they shouldn't have libeled the Browns by portraying them as dirty and illiterate is, well, you know, this isn't based on fact. This isn't you. You know, this is just, imagine it, this is just a script. So this explains why in 1951, when Paramount comes out with the second version of this film called A Place in the Sun, they change all the names. Okay, they didn't want to think about the libel suit again. They didn't want to get into what's true, what isn't true. So what they just do is change all the names. So Montgomery Clift becomes not CG, he becomes George Eastman. And Elizabeth Taylor, what other name for her? She becomes Angela, the angel, you know, just, you know. And the Grace Roberta character ends up being called Alice. A Place in the Sun, I think, is very interesting because in the 1951 film, as opposed to Dreiser's view that it was all an Arabian Nights fantasy, that Clyde Griffiths was ever going to get to be a member of the upper class. If you watch A Place in the Sun, it all seems possible. Yeah, the rich people are much nicer to Montgomery Clift, and Elizabeth Taylor really loves him, and they seem to be very accepting. And it seems as if it could actually have happened. Match Point, did you see that, Woody Allen's version? Okay, what's interesting there is that we were talking before about Vanessa, who's just so lovely, you're playing Roberta, and somebody said to her before, they said, well, you're too pretty to play Roberta. Okay, so in the movie, A Place in the Sun, Roberta is played by Shelley Winters, who cannot compete with Elizabeth Taylor. In Match Point, Woody Allen stacks the deck further by making his Roberta Grace character Scarlett Johansson. Right. Okay, so interesting going on. So I think I want to end there by just telling you that I think that this comparison of law and literature, I think I've already given you a lot of sense of all the different ways in which law and literature can interact. And again, the very interesting question of whether in some ways the arts are a better way to look at some of the real questions about legality, morality, philosophy, politics, than reality is itself. So thank you, and I look forward to getting your questions. So Francesca, do you want to come up and maybe if people have questions?
I'm good.
You're good? Okay, well, what questions do you have for Francesca or comments, people who have been studying the case? Yes, ma'am. The question is whether morality played a role at the trial with the jury, because after all, Grace was a fallen woman, even though you probably she was not the only one at the time. I mentioned to you how the prosecutor wanted to deal with that by suggesting that she had not consented, that this was not voluntary, that she must have been raped, but they didn't get away with that one. Yeah, I don't know. You know, maybe somebody else who has looked at the trial transcript has a view of whether that was important, but I think that Grace's letters really let the jury get to know her in a way that they just didn't know or like Chester Gillette. So, you know, I think that they may not have been that worried about her morality in finding him guilty. Do you have a response to that?
An observation. Weren't the letters vetted? That is, the prosecutor obtained them without the warrant.
That's right. The prosecutor did obtain the letters without the warrant. And the defense lawyer actually made a kind of primitive Fourth Amendment argument, but there was no exclusionary rule at the time. Okay, that's a good point. Yeah, we don't know all of the letters, although the prosecutor clearly had control of the letters. And that's another thing that could be different. People sometimes ask, well, what if you had the trial today? I think this whole case looks a lot different with Miranda on the picture, and it might also look different with the exclusionary rule. We might have a lot more information about what the prosecutor did with all the letters.